which we think is very helpful in the long term. And so we'll try to do it as informal as possible. And it's on this chart that's behind us on the wall. And of course, we won't be able to cover all the particulars on the chart. In fact, there are several more besides these. But this does give us a rather sound understanding of God's plan. So we'll first consider the large semicircles, the large ones, which is this here, and this here, and this here. The first semicircle is the world of Noah. And of course, Genesis, the sixth chapter, tells us that that first dispensation ended with a flood. It's called the world that was. Now, if we read in 2 Peter 3:6, we find this is a biblical expression. And we'll come back to that in a minute. The second dispensation is called this present evil world. And of course, these are only a few words taken out of the text. So when you read the account, there are other words, but we'll try to come back to that. So this is the world that was, the world before the flood, the world since the flood, which is styled this present evil world. The third dispensation is the world to come, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Now, when it says the world that was, it could not mean that the world that was, the present world, that this is talking about the planet Earth itself, not the planet. Because when the flood came in Noah's day, it did not destroy the planet. It covered the surface of the Earth and destroyed the living civilization that existed at that time, except those who, at God's command, entered into the ark that Noah built. And, of course, select animals were chosen. And all this is told us in Genesis, the sixth chapter, about the world before the flood. The world there would be the arrangement, the cosmos that existed at that time. And following the flood, we have a second dispensation called the world that now is. Or, as the Apostle Paul says, this present evil world. I think this expression, if I'm not mistaken, is in Galatians,
yes,
isn't it?
I believe so.
I didn't realize that. But an expression very similar to this is in 2 Peter 3:7. The world that now is, I think, something, an excerpt from it. When Noah came out of the ark, he came out to the same earth. It wasn't a different earth. It is told us that this is to end, this present evil world, and that there's a world to come wherein dwelleth righteousness. Well, we have in a previous study, I think, explained that the world to come wherein dwelleth righteousness, there are different features with that. There is the spiritual, those who go to heaven, and those of mankind who become obedient under the reign of Christ, called the millennium, which you're probably familiar with that term. Now, another expression, besides saying the world that was, in Peter also, it describes it, the heavens and the earth, which then existed. Now, we want to consider that expression. You'll notice that's used three times in Peter. The heavens and the earth, which were before the flood. Of course, I'm introducing a few words, but that's clearly in the context. And he mentions the heavens and the earth, which now exist or is. Then he tells about the new heavens and the new earth, as I recall it, wherein dwelleth righteousness, in that same chapter somewhere. 2 Peter, the third chapter. Now we go back again and consider this. We go over it several times because there's so much information for all of us to consider. In Hebrews, the second chapter somewhere, it tells us, I don't know if it's verse 7, that with regard to God's purpose, with regard to the future age, he tells us that he's not going to put that future age of righteousness under the administration of angels, which he previously did. So if you read that, I appreciate it.
It's the fifth verse. Hebrews 2:5. For unto the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come, whereof we speak.
All right. Now, this age, world, condition that existed prior to the flood, we read about that in Genesis. And we find that when Adam sinned, we'll have to make some statements where we can't explain all the details, that when Adam sinned, that the angels in heaven, which at one time sang for joy when they saw the creation of Adam and of Eve, it tells that the angels rejoiced as well as the sons of the morning, which was Jesus as the Logos and Satan as Lucifer before Satan sinned. Then when sin entered the world, because of Satan's ambition and desire to control the human family, because Satan could see that when God made Adam and Eve down on this little planet, he could see the potential there. Because when God said to Adam and Eve, and he gave them a garden with trees of life, and said to them that you freely can eat of all these, but just don't eat of this one tree, lest you die, or you will die, it implied that Adam and Eve would live forever if they had obeyed. And so from this human family, which God tells us in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply, this you can read very easily in the first or second chapter of Genesis. He said, be fruitful and multiply. He could see in this human pair the potential that if they fill this planet, that potentially other universes and other planets could be filled with like beings, and Satan would then be the master of a physical universe with human beings, or you might call them maybe humanoids on other planets, but not yet, because this creation was new here. He put this dispensation, God allowed the holy angels to see what they could do to lift mankind up out of the quagmire of sin. He did not give this administration to unholy angels, but to the holy angels to see what they could do. And of course they failed miserably. And I think one of the reasons why they failed miserably was because some of the holy angels themselves defected. They defected. They disobeyed God. And in Genesis, the sixth chapter, we could read that, what happened. We might as well have a little review on that. That they saw the daughters of...
Right in the beginning there.
All right, maybe Brother Barry, if you have that. What verse is this? It
starts with verse 1.
All right. Could you read that a little while?
And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years.
All right. I think that'd be probably enough now. So when man was created perfect, even when Adam sinned and he had children, they probably were very beautiful, the daughters. And the men probably were very robust and healthy, because Adam, it took 930 years for him to die. So in seeing these daughters, it says the angels saw them that they were fair and took unto themselves wives that they chose. These daughters may have been married to other humans. Whatever they wanted, they took. They chose of the daughters of men wives which they preferred. And who could resist them? Not a human being. These were angels who had materialized and used their superior powers for that purpose. Now, these were holy angels who sinned. Now you can see the problem that existed. In Hebrews, the second chapter, it tells us that the angels to whom he gave that first administration, they visited strict punishment upon the disobedient. That is, before other angels sinned. They could enforce God's law very quickly and easily in that first dispensation. I haven't got time to read, I'm just referring to it. But now when some of their own number became unholy, it was very difficult then to police the world the way it had previously been accomplished. Let us take New York City. Let us say there are 8 million people there. If you had, among 8 million people, 1 million people who are disobedient, would there be a police force sufficient with the remaining people to curb the others? It's very difficult, because you have to spread out the law enforcement agencies, and they just cannot handle the situation. And if you made it 100,000 angels being disobedient, how could the others do it? And this is what frustrated their purpose. What God was allowing was to show that holy angels and holy men, through evil communication, can be corrupted if they do not walk closely with God. That can happen. And so that was a lesson. And so the holy angels had good desires originally to lift man up out of sin. But what happened, through association with the human family, many became contaminated and fell. And the result was that this contamination spread. And finally, it was necessary to bring an end to that arrangement. And so the 120 years that you had just read refers to the building of Noah's Ark. Noah built an ark in which he put 7 pairs of clean animals that then existed and 2 pair of unclean animals that then existed at that time, contemporaneous with the human civilization. And that ark, it gives the measurements of it, 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. When you change that to feet, it is a lot like an ocean vessel in capacity, and particularly when it's built like a barge, not built with a prow and the keel like you have in present boats. So you'd have a maximal amount of capacity with this rectangular boat. So it took 120 years for the fulfillment, that is, here, about 120 years before the flood came, there was this building of the ark in here, that period of time. And then, when the proper time came, Noah was instructed to get into the ark, which he did, and his family, and these animals, and the flood came. After God sealed the door, he shut the door behind Noah, and the flood came, and eventually it destroyed all the rest of living civilization. Now, when it comes to this dispensation, we're still keeping to the large semicircles. We're not going to the lesser ones. This that's called the present evil world, instead of allowing now the holy angels to do what they could, what happened? The holy angels were unsuccessful. And the unholy ones that sinned, God imprisoned. He put in chains of darkness. That's recorded in 2 places, in Peter and in Jude. Either one of those would be sufficient. The one in Jude, which is a very short book, just before Revelation, it tells us about that.
Jude 6.
Would you read that then?
And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day.
All right. So we see that these angels that sinned, those that had taken unto themselves wives of which they chose, and it mentions that they left their first estate. The first estate that they left was heaven itself. When they left heaven and came down here and tried to help mankind, those that sinned preferred to live here. They took unto themselves wives of the human family. And of course, the wives of the human family were not angels, so they couldn't go back up. So these angels that were disobedient stayed down here. And it said that when they lived here, instead of just being messengers of God, when they lived down here, in leaving their first estate, the heavenly, that in itself showed how much they had fallen due to this particular lust that they harbored. Now, in this dispensation, God allowed another type of rulership. And in this present evil world, who's the chief authority, as it were?
Satan.
Satan himself. Satan is called the god of this world. And not that he has a right to this rulership, but he, being the prince of demons, exercised that power that he had in controlling this present dispensation. Now, the adversary, when you look up, you don't see him. You don't see the adversary. Nevertheless, he's called the god of this world because he exercises his power through mind control. He has blinded the minds of men, lest they see the glories. So he doesn't have to come down here and give orders. He's called the tempter. He's called the devil. He's called the accuser. So in this particular dispensation, Satan has ruled, usurped, illegally took, and God allowed it, because this would be a necessary lesson. This permission of evil that we see today is a lesson that's not going to be repeated a second time. And it says in the Bible, evil shall not arise a second time. I think that's in Malachi. Now, the next world to come, wherein dwelleth righteousness, the forepart of that particularly is Christ's reign in the millennial kingdom. And this reign of the millennial kingdom is the forepart of an everlasting dispensation. Not just 1,000 years. This 1,000 years has to do with educating man, instructing, lifting mankind up by stripes and judgments, both good and bad, depending on how people obey and how quickly they fall in line. And then comes a test at this part here. And at the end of the millennial age, Luke tells us, 20th chapter, I think it is, of Luke, tells us about at the end of this age. It's a fairly late verse.
Beginning 34, 20, 34 to 36.
Could you read that, someone? Anyone?
34 to 36. And Jesus answered, said unto them, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they which shall be counted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels and the children of God, being the children of the resurrection.
All right. We're going now down pretty far into the future, but this is at the conclusion of Christ's kingdom. Notice what had been read. Brother Blake had read, those accounted worthy to obtain that world or age would neither marry nor be given in marriage and neither die anymore. They would be as the angels. That's at the end. Yes?
Is that the world to come?
That's the world to come. The millennial age, in one sense, is a world to come, but that world is, as it were, instructional. But those who pass the test down here will not need any more test. If they pass, now this is not talking about the saints, those who go beyond that. They're tested now. They're being tested now. This age is with regard to mankind, not those who are with Christ in spiritual glory. They have been faithful, those that obtain that nature. And it tells us that those who are accounted worthy to obtain that age, the word world there is misunderstood again. In this concordance, you have one just to show them. This is called Young's Concordance, and it gives our English word for the Bible that we're familiar with in King James, let's say. You look up that word in this concordance, and in the Old Testament it'll tell you the Hebrew words, and in the New Testament it'll tell you the Greek words. And it's surprising that when you look these words up, you get quite a different thought. And this is authentic. This is based on the Hebrew of the Old Testament and the Greek of the New, not the English. This here. The King James is a wonderful version. We're not trying to decry that. But it does give you some misconceptions in certain places. Let's just have one more scripture on that. 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter. It speaks about Jesus' reign there. And I think this ties in with this Luke account that we just had read. Can you find that where he must reign?
He must reign till he puts all enemies. The 25th verse.
All right. A little more, it's where it gives the description a little tiny bit more than that.
For he must reign That's Christ, till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death, for he hath put all things under his feet. But when he saith, all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him.
In other words, God is accepted, because it was God who gave Jesus this authority and gave him this kingdom. God is using, he judges the world by that man whom he hath ordained, Paul tells us, which is Christ.
And I think you might want the next verse, too. All right. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all.
All right.
That's so clear. You wonder how anyone can make God and Jesus the same.
When you look at Christendom, both Catholic and Protestant, they're all confused with this Trinity doctrine. It's really very surprising. That shows the power of Satan. And to see this subject clear is a miracle. It's not because of our individual brilliance. Like Jesus said to Peter, Jesus asked the apostles, whom do men say that I am? Jesus addressed this question. And then they begin to enumerate. Well, some think you're Elijah, the prophet, or John the Baptist, or something like that. But then he said, who do you think I am? And Peter said, thou art the Christ, the Messiah,
the Son of the living God.
And Jesus said to him, blessed art thou, son of Jonah, flesh and blood hath not revealed that to thee. It was God himself that did that. So it's a miracle. To really see that subject clear is a wonderful beginning in seeing the relationship of the Father and the Son as being separate entities and on separate levels.
I agree with you. Throughout the Bible, it tells you, in some cases it tells you, God and I are in one, as
one,
and stuff like that. But he says we are as one. I mean, we are two.
And in that same chapter where he said, my Father and I are one, that same chapter he says he prayed that all his followers would be one with him, as he and the Father are one. So it's not a oneness of being, it's a oneness of person.
Spirit and sympathy.
People, they just can't seem to... can't prove it. I mean,
And they get...
Sure that.
And people can get very irate over that interpretation of Scripture.
So you'll notice that when you read 1 Corinthians 15, it says the last enemy to be destroyed is death. But the other account in Luke 20th chapter, it says those that are counted worthy to obtain that age will die no more. They'll be like the angels. That's the holy angels, not the unholy angels. So now we have given a brief synopsis of the significance of these three large dispensations. And of course, we're down in this segment in here. We're living in the, as it were, on the threshold of one age and at the ending of another, this present evil world. And some marvelous things are going to happen. And that's why you have a little fine line drawn here, because there's an interim in here in which we presently are. Now we go to the present evil world subsequent to the flood, and we see patriarchal age. The patriarchal age would mean patriarchs. God dealt then not with families per se, but individuals. And the first individual after the flood that God dealt with was?
Abraham.
No, Noah.
Noah, yes.
Because Abraham wasn't born yet.
Right.
But Noah. Mm-hmm. But his family shared, but it was, Noah was, as it were, the chief one. And he's mentioned in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, by faith about Noah, what he did in building this ark and so forth. Then after Noah, the next personality
was Enoch.
All right, now, when you say Enoch, you even went back earlier. You're going back here.
Oh, I went before the...
The only two in this dispensation, that's the 1,600 years, 1,656 years all total, the only two individuals that are specially commended is...
Enoch and Noah.
And Noah. Those are the, by name. Now, of course, his sons were obedient. They helped him with the... But they're not mentioned as being... especially righteous in God's eyes. Now, when you come, though, to this age, it starts with Noah, and Next is Abraham, and then comes
Isaac,
and Jacob. But then after Jacob,
Jacob's 12 sons were recognized as the beginning of the nation of Israel.
So when Jacob was on his deathbed, he pronounced a blessing on his sons, a prophetic blessing. And subsequent to Jacob, it's no longer especially and only one individual, but it's a family. It was the nation of Israel, as founded by these 12 sons. And so, this is called the Jewish age. It's at Jacob's, see here, death of Jacob. And then comes the opening of the Jewish age when God dealt with Israel. And God said,
you only have I known
of all the families of the earth.
All right. Showing of all the families, God only knew the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
That's in Amos 3:2.
All right, thank you. So here is the Jewish age. But the Jewish age came to an end and was replaced by a new age called the Gospel Age. And this Gospel Age, then, is comprised of what kind of people?
The Christians, those who follow Jesus.
All right, they could be a Jew, they could be a Gentile, they could be of any nation. The relationship of an individual in the Gospel Age is based upon faith in Christ. And the Apostle Paul tells us that there's no Jew or Gentile in Christ. We're all brothers, and neither male nor female, bond or free, that is, a slave or slave owner, because we read in the New Testament there were slaves who accepted Christ, and there were slave owners who accepted Christ. And, of course, that arrangement ceased not too long later, where this type of arrangement no longer exists. So in the Gospel Age, you have a calling of a family, but this family is in Christ. It's not a natural family of the Jew. It's a family in Christ. And, of course, that ends with a harvest. Jesus said, with regard to so-called Christians, he mentioned a parable. See, that would be Matthew 13, of the wheat and the tares. And Jesus speaks a parable to his disciples and likens this age. He likens this Gospel Age to the sowing and harvesting of a crop, like a farmer. What happens when the seed was planted? The disciples in the parable, they see, instead of just the wheat which was planted, wheat coming up, they see a mixture. They see wheat and false wheat, tares. Incidentally, when you look at a tare field and a wheat field, when they're coming to fruitage, you can tell which is which, in that the wheat, when the seed matures, it bows its head. The weight of the seed, it bows its head. A tare field just remains straight. And these things that are on it are so hollow and so weightless, so empty, as it were, that it does not bend. But when you look at the both grasses, they look alike. You couldn't tell it unless you were familiar with wheat and with darnel or with tares.
Brother Frank, yes. Does that mean like that, the humility of the...
Right, that's humility is one, yes, one of the main...
Quality.
So the disciples in the parable, like they say, well, what should we do, Master, with this tare? And he says, let both grow together until a harvest. And that's what's happened all down the last 2,000 years. You have so-called Christianity. The tare is a professed Christian. The wheat is a professed Christian. But there's a difference. One is recognized by God. The other is not recognized by God. One is just a mere professor and not a doer and not having that kind of zeal. And the wheat, of course, are the children of the kingdom, he tells in the parable. So here's the Gospel Age. And then there is to be this harvest where a time will come when it's going to be apparent who the true Christian is and the false Christian. And this is something that's coming in the not-too-distant future. there's some hard times coming. In that separating time of the future, it will become more discernible by those who profess to be Christians. Some will not want to profess Christianity at that time, because even to nominally profess, the people are going to get so hateful in the future that they want to do away with Christianity. And they want to do away with the true Christianity and also the false, because they don't know the difference. They think everybody's a hypocrite. And so in that period of time, it's going to be very stressful. But the Lord does say, before this exceedingly troublesome time, that those who are of the little flock, they're at least going to be spared this particular type of trial, and they will have a trial on an individual basis rather than as a lump sum basis. I can't take the time to go into that now. Now, we have now more or less shown the simple outline of God's purpose, and we're down here at the ends of the two dispensations, the beginning of the one and the ending of the other. Now, another marvelous thing which is different with the Bible than with any other book, whether it's Chinese or Chaldean or Egyptian and so forth, is that we have time periods, mathematical. So when you read in Genesis, it tells us in the fifth chapter of Genesis that when Adam was 130 years of age, he had a son called Seth. Seth, when he was 105 years of age, begat a son, Enos. Enos, when he was 90 years of age, begat Canaan. The thing is this, that we can add these up, just like you do in simple arithmetic. You add these up here, and you find that they total 1,656 years. This 1,654 has to do from the sin, when Adam sinned. But 1656 is from the creation of Adam, when he was first made. So you add that up, and now we know what the first dispensation was. Where do you find this information in the world? They think the world is millions of years old. The world has no concept, and they looked at some bones in the earth, and from these bones they say, well, this is the dinosaur age, and this is this age, and this is this, and they talk in the figures millions of years. But the Bible doesn't say how old the planet is, but it does tell us how old humanity is. And here it is. It tells us. And when God created Adam, didn't he say, let us make man in our own image? Doesn't that suggest that it had never been done before, this type of a person? It's something new that had not been done before. So when it says that he created Adam, and we read about what he did in Genesis, we find that it gives how old he was before he had a son and so forth all the way down the line. And so we know the length of time of this dispensation. Now the next thing, when we come to the patriarchal age, in the same book of Genesis, chapter 11, tells us that Shem begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And Arphaxad was 35 years of age when he begat Salah, and Salah was 30 years of age when he begat Eber, and so forth. And so, up until Jacob's death, we have a mathematical period of time. No other history like this. But it's strange that all these archaeologists and historians, they go every place but the Bible. They don't really believe the Bible that much. And so they estimate how long this civilization was, and they put it down in a book, this estimation, and people accept it, because anything's in print, they think, so that makes it right. But this Bible has existed for thousands of years, this Bible, long before. And when you see this accuracy, it's like God putting his reputation on the line with these figures. But science is directly contradicting the Bible. And that's why Paul says, science falsely so-called. We as humans have been blessed with a mind where we can reason. But no matter how well we reason, unless we are on a firm foundation, all the building doesn't mean anything. All the brilliance of showing the little steps and so forth in human reasoning doesn't mean anything unless you have the right base from which to build. If the foundation isn't right, well, then the whole building is built falsely. Except the Lord build the house.
They labor in vain.
Now, so we have here a simple mathematical calculation as to the period of time involved up to the death of Jacob. See, this continues right on down. And then we can tell when God called Abraham. 427 years after the flood, God called Abraham to leave Ur of Chaldees. The 430 years here bridges this void, because after the death of Jacob, you try in the Bible, it'll give you a lot of information, but it becomes very difficult to piece it together mathematically. You can do it genealogically, but not this time period aspect. That's the problem. But this is bridged two different ways. This 430 years is supplied to us by Exodus, when they came out of Egypt. It tells us in the book of Exodus that it was 430 years to the day that they left Egypt. So that tells us then when the Exodus was, 430 years after the covenant with Abraham. How long were they in the wilderness of Sinai?
40 years.
And that's mentioned several times in the Bible, several times. Then the dividing of the land is 6 years, and the way we calculate that is, it tells us the age of Joshua, Caleb also enters into the situation, when they were first recognized for their faith manifestation, and then he says, I am this day 86 years of age. I was 40 when I left Egypt. I'm doing it in my own language. He says, so if you subtract 40 from 86, you get 46 years, 40 of which were in the wilderness, and the 6 years to the day he was speaking, and when came the period of the judges. Now, the period of the judges, you can even approximate this 450 years, which I have done on the table. But actually, it's not even needed, because this 450 years is told to us in, I think it's Acts, the 7th chapter. I think that's Stephen's testimony, if I'm not mistaken. He says, God gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. Then, the last judge was Samuel. And the first king was
Saul.
And it tells us how long Saul reigned, how long David reigned, how long Solomon reigned. So we have this period of time, the 513, based upon the length of the reign of each king. Back here, it was the age of the individual when they had a son. And then that son, how old that son was when he had a son. And so that's mathematical. But this period of 513 years, in principle, is very similar. The only difference is, it tells how long they each reigned. Saul, we're told, reigned 40 years. David reigned 40 years. Solomon reigned 40 years. And then comes the others, which are mentioned in the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles. And then you add that up until you come to the captivity to Babylon. So we're not going to go any further than that as far as this, because this is not basically a chronological talk. What we're trying to say is that these ages, that God has his own time clock. God has his own time clock. When Christ came at his first advent, it says in the fullness of time, mentions about Christ coming. And from this chart, other calculations can be made, because now we have a baseline. We know the length of history. And so from this fixed history, which is based on these, this, and these periods here, on this fixed basis now, we can attach the prophetic time periods that are mentioned in the Bible, and there are several of them. In Daniel, the 12th chapter, we're told about a time, times and half a time, which is 1260 days. We're told about the 1290 days. We're told about 1335 days. And each day is a day for a year. These days that are mentioned in prophecy are prophetic time periods, a day signifying, in these particular instances, 1 year. Here, you only have one mentioned on this chart. Kind of complicated when you look at it. But actually, this 1335 is comprised of 1260, a 1290, as well as a 1335. And all starting here in the middle of nowhere, it appears. But that period of time starts with the abomination of desolation being set up, we're told in the prophecy. And that had to do with the establishment of the false church in the earth, which is papacy, we believe. That's a false church. The Lord has allowed this system to exist as a testing for God's saints. I have several books here that tell about martyrs, what the unbelievable horrors and persecutions that Catholics inflicted upon Christians because they had a Bible or that they didn't study in their church, that they questioned certain practices and certain doctrines of this particular period of time. And so this is a starting point here, was in the reign of the Emperor Justinian, when he said that the Roman Catholic Church was the true church of Christ in both the Eastern and Western empires. Because in Constantinople, when he issued this decree, he was like a successor of Constantine the Great. And he recognized the Pope of the Western Empire as being the chief authority even in the Eastern Empire. And that recognition in 539 A.D. is a very important point from which these prophetic time periods are pointed out. Now, I think we've discussed quite a bit. We'll just go a few things. This millennial age is an age called the restitution of all things. And that's in Acts, the third chapter. The verses are there, which it tells us that the perfection that was lost here, when Adam was perfect in the Garden of Eden, perfect health and so forth, that this is going to be restored in this period of time. So some refer to it this way beautifully, that when we read Genesis, we read a paradise lost, because the paradise was forfeited or lost. When we read the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, we find paradise regained. It tells us when we read in the 20th chapter of Revelation about God shall wipe away tears from off all faces, so forth. That is of the obedient. We will not discuss this, because this would take a little time to prove this, which can only be done really in a little study with a blackboard and go into the nitty-gritty of all this little detail. But that's mathematical. Be proven and shown very, very readily, but not in this type of a discussion. And so, this then is that God has permitted evil to indicate to his holy angels his own wisdom, that he, through Christ, is the only one that can really bring happiness to all his creatures, the Creator himself, that every created being should, no matter on what plane of being are, that they should have implicit faith and obedience in their Creator, rather than in unauthorized other helps. These holy angels who tried to lift mankind, God just allowed them to do it. He wasn't specially back of them. It wasn't his authorized world. He allowed them to see what they could do. And then he allowed Satan to usurp his authority and apparently not do anything about it. And that was a great trial. That was a great trial when God did not stop the evil there. And that tested the mettle of all his creatures since then up to the present time. And then comes this age, and then after that is the world to come. It's spoken of as an unending age. I think it's in Ephesians where it mentions this period of time, and that's eternity. So this dispensation, the world to come, has no end. It's infinity. And I guess that's it tonight, because we don't want to
What I'd like to request then is that the scriptures you started out with, which are on that chart, maybe we could read them because we referred to them, but...
All right, I meant to, but I didn't. All right,
okay,
could you
Peter help? Particularly, 2 right, Peter? Third chapter, 2 Peter 3:6. Maybe we can start with verse 5. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. So I'm saying the world that existed at that time perished with the flood. Then this next verse, verse 7, but the heavens and the earth which are now, or the present evil world, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. And then the same chapter refers to the third dispensation, is that verse 13? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness.
All right, maybe we could review some other pertinent information. We'll try not to take too much time. This first part that you read about the world that then mm-hmm. was perished and about the earth standing out of the water and in the water, it tells us in Genesis that before the flood it had never rained. It tells us that. And thus when Noah built a boat on land and was telling about a future flood that would inundate the earth, they thought he was really crazy. And this spending a century building a boat on dry land, and it had never rained, it tells us that the moisture each day came up from the soil itself. It came up from the soil and watered the vegetation. But God told Noah what his purpose was, and that's why he's listed as a great man of faith in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Because of his obedience and doing this. And they mocked him. And thus, when you read Peter, which your quotation was from, he tells that they scoffed at Noah at that time. Now, the thing is this, it says that actually, though, they did not know that there was a tremendous volume of water above the earth. But that water above the earth was diffused. It was diffused. So when they looked up, they could not see the water. They looked through the water. It was translucent. But it was there. And then the earth itself is standing in water. In fact, 75% of the earth is water. You have the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, and so forth. Only one quarter of this. So when it says they didn't realize this, they didn't realize the potential that if it were not for God keeping these separate, both the oceans as well as the water above the earth, that impending catastrophe existed and they were completely unaware of it. And here's Noah building this boat on dry land. But when the right time came, and the Lord knew exactly when this veil would break and inundate the earth, and when the continent would sink, allowing the oceans to come in and cover the civilized earth of Noah's day, that these two things, the waters above as well as the waters around in which the inhabitants were dwelling on dry land, where the water around, that came in, they didn't realize it until it happened. And when the flood occurred, there were no unbelievers. And they tried to get into the ark, but they couldn't get in because the Lord told Noah to not only daub it with slime, or a pitch like a tar, bitumen, inside and outside, when they would try to hang on to the ark, they couldn't. It was too slimy.
The Lord shut the door.
And the Lord shut the door so they couldn't get in. Then we have the picture of what Peter was telling about this first dispensation. Now he said that was overflowed by water and perished. But then he says in this same chapter that this present evil world is reserved unto fire. But this fire is not a literal fire, and we'll try to prove it. Oh, there are several, but we'll only take one simple one. In Zephaniah, the third chapter, verses 8 and 9. Zephaniah, there was only one or two pages between that and Zechariah. Zephaniah comes before Zechariah. There's Haggai in Haggai
third
in between.
Third chapter,
verses 8 and 9. If you could read that.
Therefore, wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. For then will I turn to the people a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of the Lord, to serve him with one consent.
All right. Now this fire is a figurative or symbolic fire, the fire of God's indignation. And this can be shown by several prophets, not just this one. There are several others. But you'll notice it says that when he pours upon the nations the fire of his indignation, it says that then he turns to the people a pure language. So it means that after his wrath has weeded out the corrupt element in society, we're speaking in broad terms, when he cleanses the earth, as it were, of the wicked doer, he turns to the ones left, those who remain. He turns to them a pure language, that they then, under that circumstance, can serve God with fullness of knowledge. They will know now who the true God is, that they might all serve him with one consent. Yes?
I got a question. Will that language be like the language that was before the Tower of Babylon?
It could very well be.
Something like that?
Yeah, very good.
Confused?
I think it's very likely. Those are the only two points we want to follow about this earth standing out of the water and in the water. That can be perplexing when you read it, as well as the fire. Remember that in Isaiah it says, it was God's determination to gather all nations to Jerusalem to battle. And there he even uses expressions about the fire of his indignation. He tells that it will come up into his face. In other words, God has been holding back, as it were, from interfering with earth's affair, just letting this evil come to a climax. Then it tells that it rises up into his face, and then what does he do? He rolls his sleeves up and makes bare his holy arm of indignation. In other words, we believe that the kingdom will be established in Israel when the ancient worthies come forth from the tomb and God destroys the armies coming from the north, called under the figure of Gog from the land of Magog, and associate nations come down to Jerusalem, and America, France, and England are pictured as Sheba, Dedan, and Tarshish, the young lions thereof. The British Commonwealth has the symbol of a lion. Sheba is from the ends of the earth, in another book of the Bible, meaning from Jerusalem, we are, as it were, in the hinterland. If you were standing in Jerusalem, America is way, way distant in the coasts of the earth, as it were, and Dedan is closer. That, we believe, is France. But then the ones that come down would be the communist powers who, in the end of this age, determine to destroy Israel. And he will allow them to be apparently victorious. And this is going to be a very crucial test to those that have some faith, because when they see Jerusalem taken and there's abuse of the people, it will seem that the evangelical churches, some of them have been teaching that when Russia comes down, they'll be destroyed. But they have the thought it'll be immediately. But the scriptures indicate that the city shall be taken. It's afterward, when it seems total defeat and total victory on behalf of the ones that come down, that then the trouble starts. And it says, then shall the Lord go forth and fight for his people as he did in the days of old. And these are scriptures. I'm not making them up. I mean, they're verbatim. We're quoting them. And so we see that that particular fire is a fire of trouble. And when you read the newspapers, it sometimes tells you that Europe is on fire, meaning there's a lot of revolution and discontent being manifested, such as we see in China at present. Figuratively can be easily described as being the fire of anarchy and revolt, as it were. But this is only an indication of what's in store. So the Lord's people are promised that if they're faithful, they will escape that particular tribulation, they that are accounted worthy. So this expression, accounted worthy, is used in Matthew 24, another part of that chapter. Then there shall be a time of tribulation, such as there never was since there was a nation to that time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be cut short, there would be no flesh saved. But, he says, those days will be cut short.
By the elect.
By the elect. And then it tells, though, before that, those that are accounted worthy will escape that particular experience. Not that they will escape suffering or death, but not that kind of in the anarchy.
Brother Frank,
yes.
I have that scripture. It's Luke about escaping.
All right.
Luke 21:36. Watch ye therefore and pray always that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man.
All right. So I think I've spoken enough tonight. There's so much in God's plan that can be considered, and there's just so much we can fully absorb at one time. Any of us, as far as that goes, the magnitude of it. So if there's no special question, I think God will then conclude this service with prayer.